You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 16th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of sociology at New York University, Vivek Chibber, author of The Class Matrix, Social Theory After the Cultural Turn. Meanwhile, Russia-Ukraine talks continue as Zelensky acknowledges that Ukraine will not join NATO. Give me one second. Meanwhile, Zelensky addresses Congress and asks for more aid as Biden announces $1 billion military aid being sent to Ukraine. Meanwhile, speaking of aid, COVID relief aid for this country is completely stalled as the Republicans want pay fors. Meanwhile, nine Democratic lawmakers get COVID after their congressional retreat. Thank God we don't have to worry about that anymore.
It's on the rear view.
Oily Joe Manchin sinks Sarah Bloom Raskin's nomination as she announces she will withdraw from confirmation hearings for her to sit on the Fed. Pfizer seeks its fourth shot for seniors as new data shows that J&J pretty effective. North Korea launches another weapon, 10th the past couple of weeks. And this one blows up shortly after takeoff. Hearings will begin in Congress on a massive revamp of the VA. Former Proud Boy leader is jailed pending a January 6th trial. And the Senate approves a bill to make daylight savings time permanent. Onto the House. We'll see. Lastly, Ohio Republicans have some problems in their Senate primary race. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Pardon my frog in the throat. Sometimes that happens. I think I'm starting to get a little bit of allergies. I've tested multiple times today, actually, so don't worry. Joining me, also, don't worry, I've tested.
Mm-hmm.
Emma Vigeland.
Yeah. Hi. I mean, I'm just, you were coughing. We'll be fine.
Yeah.
We'll be fine.
Yeah. Folks, here are the air filters going on in here. I was, we're not sure if I was directly exposed to someone who had, COVID, but someone who's tested last night, I had seen like a day before.
Mm.
And, I have taken multiple tests. And also, as you saw, just had a coughing fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we do have, you may hear the sound of our air filters. We have redeployed the air filters into more strategic locations. Matt, just so you know, there's an air filter between us. And also there's one that's pulling right across that way so that the airflow is on the side.
My request for an air filter between us predated COVID, but I'm glad it's here now.
That's right. Matt used to wear a mask in here pre-COVID, just because.
He could have seen it coming.
Yep.
Operational security.
He heard too many of those ad reads where I talked about not using antiperspirant. So Zelensky addressed our Congress just moments ago, I guess. And they, of course, these remarks were delivered virtually. And let's take a listen.
In your great history, you have pages that would allow you to understand Ukrainians. Understand us now, when you need it right now, when we need you right now. Remember Pearl Harbor, terrible morning of December 7, 1941, when your sky was black from the planes attacking you. Just remember it. Remember September the 11th, a terrible day in 2001 when evil tried to turn your cities, independent territories, in battlefields, when innocent people were attacked from air. Yes. Just like no one else expected it. You could not stop it. Our country experiences the same every day, right now, at this moment, every night, for 3 weeks now. Various Ukrainian cities, Odessa and Kharkiv, Chernihiv and Sumy, Zhytomyr and Lviv, Mariupol and Dnipro. Russia has turned the Ukrainian sky into a source of death for thousands of people. Russian troops have already fired nearly 1,000 missiles at Ukraine. Countless bombs. They use drones to kill us with precision. This is a terror that Europe has not seen for 80 years, and we are asking for a reply, for an answer to this terror from the whole world. Is this a lot to ask for? To create a no-fly zone over Ukraine to save people? Is this too much to ask? Humanitarian no-fly zone, something that Ukraine, that Russia would not be able to terrorize our free cities. If this is too much to ask, we offer an alternative. You know what kind of defense systems we need, S-300 and other similar systems. You know how much.
I think that what Zelensky is asking there for is like some type of Iron Dome or something to that effect.
Yeah. Which is understandable from his perspective. It's also, I mean, a no-fly zone, it's incumbent upon the West to also just be disciplined in or NATO and not grant that request, I think.
Of course. I mean, it's to be expected that he would call for it. It's to be expected that this is their perspective. And the problem is, it's not just a no-fly zone. It is a step into a conflict that is basically just opening the door to widen it much more. And it can't happen. This is, and I think so far, at least, the administration is being, disciplined. Despite the fact there's an enormous pressure, it seems to me. But here is...
here's some of that pressure.
Yep. This is Jen Psaki at the White House press conference.
Zelensky and other Ukrainian officials have made so clear that what they believe they need the most is more warplanes and fighter jets. So why is the U.S. assessing something different? Why does the U.S. believe they know better what Ukraine needs than what Ukrainian officials are saying they need the most?
It sounds like, you know, we're pretty dug in on our position when it comes to the no-fly zone, when it comes to the MiGs, despite this growing call, bipartisan call in Congress to shift a little bit. So to put it bluntly, is Zelensky wasting his time tomorrow asking for these things?
President Zelensky is going to be speaking to Congress tomorrow. He's been pushing for fighter jets, a no-fly zone. You have to hear some of those same requests tomorrow as well. Has the administration shifted on that at all?
Really, though, calling for a no-fly zone. There is a NATO member They share a border with Russia. How do we view their calls for a no-fly zone?
And on President Zelensky's address tomorrow, of course, he is expected to ask for more assistance, as my colleague noted. A lot of the U.S. positions on that haven't changed, as you just said, when it comes to the no-fly zone. But on the aircraft specifically, the Pentagon said last week that Secretary Austin said they do not support the transfer of additional fighter aircraft at this time. Is that still the United States' position?
Would a strike in Poland on supplies or anything, really, automatically be met with a military forceful response, which would be a conversation amongst allies about how to know what's a Russian drone made its way into Polish airspace before going back to Ukraine and being shot down. Does a drone into Poland count?
Former ambassador to Ukraine, Maria Ivanovich, has been quite outspoken recently. And she said, we need to mitigate risk, but it's also true that not taking greater action comes with the risk as well, because Putin is a bully and he only understands strength. Is the president showing enough strength against Putin?
Oh, my God.
All right. I mean, I think, yeah, we get the idea that The Intercept put that together, but it's amazing. Like, as I've said multiple times on the show, there's no understanding of what a no-fly zone means in the general public. There was that poll that came out. There's a perception that it's some sort of force field or, like, magical, invisible superhero dome over Ukraine, when what it means is shooting down Russian planes. The Russian Air Force is the second largest air force in the world, only second to the United States. This would constitute war. And, like, you, again, it's entirely understandable that Zelensky is asking for this. From his perspective, I get it. He wants to protect his people. They're under siege. It's a terrifying situation. But for the press to do this, and not, you know, the few times we used no-fly zones, it was against vastly inferior military forces and did not have like a World War III or nuclear type consequence attached to it. The fact that they continue to put that out there without a real weighing of the consequences is unconscionable. It really is.
So you're okay with a bully being bullied?
You want to do a conversation and not a forceful response? Okay, sure.
Okay.
I'm invested in America's weakness, and I also apparently hate Ukraine.
Were you ever bullied in junior high?
I was the bully.
Okay. All right. And no, so not really. The point being is that it's just so bizarre to me that when you're talking about this type of geopolitical conflict, that people are literally going back to this experience from elementary school or this experience from junior high.
It's a nuclear capability of a bully.
I mean, the dynamic of a bully, it's not the same.
Yeah.
It's like,
bullies
don't know
have
what to,
nukes?
It's not even the stakes are different. The dynamics, not the same. A bully doesn't have domestic pressures. A bully does not have power in a group of people who could overthrow the bully internally. The bully doesn't have tens or hundreds of years of history of various constituencies that are at play here. To do the bully thing, it's just like, I mean, I get it when politicians get up there and say this when they're on the stump. But for reporters who are ostensibly there talking in serious voices so they can appear to have, like, you know, like be learned in these topics, to use the bully thing is just like, I mean.
It's infantile.
Almost literally.
Yeah.
It's almost also worse literally than that, too, because there is an investment, even if it's more subtle to them and they don't perceive it, in the perception of, like, American might, and also the investment in conflict for conflict's sake. I mean, there are war correspondents in this country push for more conflict and more action, I should say, for a reason. They're invested in it. It's helpful for their career, and it's something that they are, I think, there's a subliminal understanding that this is just this is better for us.
Well, I think also for those people, those people in the White House who are asking those questions, it is the quickest route to being perceived as being serious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because if you are willing to ask the tough questions to see if you're going to make the tough decisions, which means always when you hear the tough choices, tough decisions, hard choices, hard decisions, that is always in the context of politics or media, it is always deciding that other people are going to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
It's either you're going to be making sacrifices in terms of like being able to pay your bills, or we're going to be sending your kids or other people's kids to die in a war. It is always that. And because you're willing to do that and to make that tough call, that and make that hard decision, it gives you some type of gravitas. I have looked death straight in the eyes and sent other people towards
right, it. Not and your death.
That is not. Well, that's what makes it hard. It's one thing to decide that I myself am going to go to war.
Yeah.
I mean, that's second in some way, notice. That's an easy decision. I can either make it or not make it.
And that's a decision.
But it's a hard decision to make too, for right. other people.
Yeah. There's this quote Ben Rhodes, a foreign policy guy under Obama, had that pissed a lot of people off. But I think it's true. All these newspapers used to have foreign bureaus. Now they don't. They call us to explain to them what's happening in Moscow and Cairo. Most of the outlets are reporting on world events from Washington. The average reporter we talk to is 27 years old, and their only reporting experience consists of being around political campaigns. That's a sea change. They literally know nothing.
And he was saying that, and that allowed us to manipulate them.
Exactly.
But it's a bigger problem than just smart people take advantage of that mm-hmm. situation. Later in the show, we'll play this question from Ryan Grimm, which was actually a really smart question and gets to, you know, how the potential to get out of this situation. But before we get to Vivek Chibber on his book, The Class Matrix, Social Theory After the Cultural Turn, a word from our sponsors today. As you know, folks, I am always trying to watch what I eat. I have a real problem when I get around anything that's sugary.
Oh,
I see that the candy is taken out of my line of sight. I appreciate that. I'm going to assume it's gone from the room so I don't have to worry about it. One of the ways it's I've been able gone. To deal with this. Are you serious? One of the ways that I have dealt with this, satisfied my sweet tooth, dealt with late night snacks for several years now, I feel like it's been. And that is Magic Spoon. 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving, only 140 calories per serving. It is keto friendly. It is gluten free. It is grain free. It is soy free, and it is low carb. And Magic Spoon, they allow you now, they have, I think it's like a half a dozen great flavors of cereal. Some flavors my kids love, some flavors I love, and you can build your own box. You can customize, you can either get a full box, you know, 4, I think it is, that come in a package of cocoa, fruity, frosted, reminds you of the childhood flavors, peanut butter, blueberry, cinnamon, my favorite, cookies and cream, and maple waffle. And you can mix and match those now in a box. Every now and then they get some special flavors that come through. Those are also awesome to try. This is, it's healthy, yet it's also delicious. And it makes it easy for you to feed these to your kids too, because you don't feel bad.
Hmm.
Go to magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Grab a custom bundle of cereal. Be sure to use our promo code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout to save $5 off your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/majorityreport and use the code MAJORITYREPORT to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode, sponsoring my breakfast many times a week, and midnight snacks, which are actually closer, probably at 3 a.m.
3 a.m. snacks.
Yep. I wake up and I'm like, I'm hungry. Damn it. And then I just make a bowl of cereal.
It's hard to sleep when you're hungry.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the latest IPCC report that came out, not good news. We need a society-wide addressment of climate change, but there's an opportunity, obviously, for all of us to help to the extent that we can. And also, it's, you know, it's not just virtue signaling, it is signaling. And it's not just about virtue, it's about saving money, it's about reducing your carbon footprint, and it's about also suggesting to others that this is doable and we can do it and we should be doing it. So now is the time to go solar. 2022 is the last year of the 26% tax credit before it drops down to 22%. Longtime fan of the show and listener of this program has become a solar consultant. He's got years of experience working in the solar industry. In fact, he was working for one of these solar companies, found that in some instances, some of the companies work for, their leasing programs are a little bit predatory. And he realized that homeowners don't have anybody to help navigate this, both navigate in terms of like finding contractors, navigating, finding what tax breaks and incentives are there. And a lot of homeowners aren't aware of the solar options that are available to them. You can now retrofit a home with solar panels for no money down. Most homeowners that switch over see significant savings starting in their first year, largely due to this tax credit. My Solar Nerd's mission is simple. Help you find the best solar program for your home. Make the transition as easy and smooth as possible. They do it by analyzing your usage, finding the best equipment for your needs, determining incentives and financing that you qualify for. And then they project manage the process between you and the installers. They get the permits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do not wait. Like I say, some of those tax credits and incentives are sunsetting. They may be sunsetting in your state. The current 26% tax credit drops down to 22%. If a project is completed by the end of this year, the homeowner qualifies for the 26%. So there's still time. Some markets that are prone to power outages may qualify for off-grid backup solutions. Majority Report listeners will get a $200 gift card upon installation of their solar system. So check it out. Go to mysolarnerd.com. Fill out the inquiry form now. Make sure you select Majority Report listener for how you heard about My Solar Nerd to receive that $200 gift card upon installation. Check it out. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Vivek Chibber, the class matrix social theory after the cultural turn. We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Joining myself and Emma Vigeland, Professor Vivek Chibber, Professor of Sociology at New York University, author of The Class Matrix, Social Theory After the Cultural Turn. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We got this is a sort of an academic read to some extent, but I think it's available to everybody. But I want to walk through, folks. This is, in some ways, a slight history of Marxist theory and where you feel that it certain turns sort of were not successful in addressing a question, which is essentially why, when we have seemingly a broad awareness that capitalism is not working for many, 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 the vast majority of people in our society and in many other societies, why do we still have capitalism? Right? I mean, that is the central question that you are revising or adding to Marxist theory to address. So let's go back and give us the history of that Marxist theory up until the cultural turn, and tell us what the cultural turn was when we get there.
Yeah, thanks. It's not really just Marxist theory, although addressing the turns within the changes in Marxism is important, because for a century, this was the theory that guided the left. But really, for the entire left, there was an understanding for over 100 years that if you want to figure out how to change capitalism and why capitalism is so hard to change, you've got to look at people's material circumstances, the choices that they have, the constraints that they face, and the way in which they try to do the best that they can for themselves in those constraints, and workers being the main object here. So the idea was, look, if workers aren't rising up the way everyone thought they would, it has to be because the choices that they have make it really hard for them, really difficult for them to organize around their interests, even though they know that they're being screwed over. Now, that was, anarchists believed this, socialists believed this, Marxist socialists believed this, non-Marxist socialists. All the disagreements were about how to go about organizing and what your vision of a humane, just society is. There was no disagreement that workers are basically rational, reasonable people trying to do the best they can under their circumstances. Well, what changed in that was starting probably around the 80s or so, it really took hold that it's not that a rational, reasonable response to their constraints that's keeping them where they are, but it's that they've internalized a lot of ideology, the culture, the socialization, what they're told by the media, by the church, by politicians. And so they believe what they're told. Now, this had a disastrous effect, in my opinion, in the culture of the left and how we understand capitalism. Because whereas earlier, if you took it for granted that people basically understand their situation, they basically understand that they're being screwed over, they basically understand that they need to do something about it. But the reason they're not doing something about it is because their bosses will fire them, or because it's just too hard to organize because they don't have the time to organize, things like that. Then you work on those things with them. And you try to understand the specifics of each situation so that you can make it less intimidating for them. But once you believe that they actually don't really understand their circumstances, that they don't really know what to do, that they don't really understand that they're being exploited or treated badly, you start thinking that they're fools, that they're dupes, that they're easily manipulated. And it drives a wedge between the left and the people who is trying to organize, because now suddenly, instead of organizers thinking, we have to figure out what their conditions are and how to make it better for them to organize, you start thinking, oh, these guys, they don't really understand what's going on, and it's up to us to enlighten them. And it generates kind of elitism, and that elitism is now rampant on the left towards working people. So the motivation for the book was to try to show what the problems are in this approach and the disastrous effects that it's had.
Okay, and so that idea that that the workers did not understand how they were being exploited and was submerged, that understanding was submerged or maybe repressed, submerged, I think is probably the best word, by all the ideological players that are surrounding them in society, is that concept of false consciousness, right? Is that? Okay. And so, this turn, the cultural turn, came about in the early 80s, I guess, is what. Because there wasn't necessarily a response to the question of why capitalism hasn't fallen up to that point, because it appeared like it was going to. Right.
Up until the 40s. Yeah.
Will you just like outline that for us? Like, give us a sense of, like, it was very widely believed that we were on track through the first half of the 20th century, that it's sort of a matter of time.
Yeah, I mean, let's step back for a second. you go back to the 19th century, Marx and Engels, and Marx and Engels right there, creates its own grave diggers, was the term they used. Capitalism creates a working class, it exploits that working class, but that class is positioned to overthrow the system, because both because it needs to, because it's being treated so badly, and because the whole system runs on its labor. So if that class holds back its labor or even rises up, the system's gone. And it's just a matter of time before that happens. And the socialist movement is built on that conviction. In the 1890s, the early 1900s, that's when you see the socialist movement coming together. And starting, I would say, in 1905 or so, all the way up until the 1940s, what do we see? All across Europe and in much of the developing world, there's revolutions. Regimes are overthrown. If they're not overthrown, they're on the cusp of being overthrown. So it really does look like the system is imploding, like it's driving itself into the ground out of its own sort of internal engines. That's what changes after 45. Now, once in the post-war world, it's becoming clear that the system isn't going to collapse. This question becomes important, which is, why doesn't it collapse? It was looking like it would. During that early 20th century, when all these revolutions were occurring, nobody's asking the question, hey, how come capitalism doesn't implode? Because it was imploding. All the questions were, how can we push it further along? How can we accelerate this whole process of capitalism's collapse? It's when, in the 1950s onward, it stabilizes itself that the question arises, why does it remain stable when it's true, as Marx said, or the socialist and anarchist said, workers are exploited, they are treated badly, they do have an interest in organizing, why don't they? That's when they start thinking, maybe it's culture. Maybe it's the ideology.
But the stabilizing force, would you attribute that to the labor movement? Or, what do you think stabilized it and gave this false sense of security?
Well, my point is that I don't think it's culture. I think that during this whole revolutionary era, what was overlooked was that it's in exceptional circumstances that workers are able to get organized. And we've lived through that in your lifetime and mine. What we've seen is organizing unions is actually really hard. And in much of the developing world, it's always been the case. There's no big, the biggest proportion of unionized workers were always in the West, not in the global South, even after capitalism came there. And in the last 50 years, the proportion of workers in unions has been declining everywhere. So what we see is that the whole episode of an organized working class and a mobilized working class is actually quite exceptional in the history of capitalism. So the question then becomes, what's the norm? What's the baseline situation in capitalism? The baseline is the reason they don't organize, the reason they don't all come together is not because they're duped or not because of ideology. It's because when you get a job, your fundamental concern is holding on to that job, because the employer's got the power to hire and fire you. And when you try to organize, you've got to do it in circumstances that it's more likely that you'll lose your job than you'll bring other people together with you. And when you try to bring them together with you, each and every person now has to come together on a platform in which people have different needs and different obligations to each other. You've got to agree on what you're going to fight for. You're going to agree whether it's paid vacations that you prioritize or whether it's medical care, whether it's the wage level or whether it's the pace of work. The bringing people together around these interests, escaping the eye of the boss, figuring out what a good strategy is, these are all material, structural constraints that workers have, even if they know that they're being treated like they're being exploited and treated badly. So my argument for what stabilizes the system is the mundane everyday facts about the power dynamics, the power imbalance between employer and employee, worker and boss, and the mundane facts about all the resources and all the costs that they have to take on to organize themselves. It doesn't take ideology to get them to move away from that. It's just the bare structural facts about where they are.
And you label that dynamic, at least in terms of the way that the worker approaches that, as resignation. And I want to come back to that. But there's still one question in that moment where the question is, when things stabilize, or there's awareness of the stabilization in the 1950s, And it's and then the question is like, you know, why is it stabilized is answered at that moment by the cultural turn. But why was the question, why was the question, why is it stabilized, as opposed to what were the factors that changed the situation? In other words, if, you know, prior to World War II, there's this sense that like this is impending. It's a question of time. We can try, you know, things to accelerate it or not. But this is happening. And if you looked around, you had every reason to believe that.
Yeah.
Where was the question of like what changed? What over the course of these 10 years or whatever it was? I mean, it's obviously there was a world war. But what about the response to the war that inhibited all of these things? Or was it like, you know, like, you know, was it Taft-Hartley was there some, you know, Bruce Lee kidney punch that like 3 weeks later is when you die? Like what happened during that time? And why is that not examined as a way of bringing out what a response to the stabilization that was being seen, you know, in the 50s or addressed?
You know, in the 50s and 60s, I don't think this cultural answer to the question was ruled a roost the way it did by the 80s and 90s. If we trace back this whole turn to culture in the 80s, we can trace it back to the 50s as when this line of thinking begins and starts gathering steam. But actually, in the 50s and 60s, when there was still a trade union movement, there were still communist parties and socialist parties, they were asking the questions, Sam, the way you've just posed them, which is not that, oh, there's some deep, dark secret in capitalism that we missed before. They were thinking in terms of there's something has changed between the 30s and the 50s that's made things a lot harder for us. And they did look at things like the post-war boom, the enormous rise in working class standards of living, the fact that unions have become compromised and they've kind of bought into the system and they're more in the job of managing workers rather than mobilizing workers. The strain of thought was very much there. And you can think of the 50s and 60s as a time when there's these two streams of thought within the left. One is this kind of cultural thinking, and the other is more strategic, more looking at the facts on the ground and what's changed on the ground. What happens is, by the 70s, the social groups, social organizations that are thinking in a strategic way, the way you're saying, they're getting their asses kicked. They are in retreat. The left is collapsing. The trade unionists are in the left wing of the trade union movement is in retreat everywhere. And the thinking about capitalism is taken over by professional academics, by professional intellectuals. And in that class of people, it really doesn't pay to be talking about strategic dilemmas in organizing against capitalism and what's changed for organizers, because they don't do any of the organizing and their professional interests aren't bound up with the success of labor organizing. First of all, they're very distant from everyday concerns and lives of workers. So it's easy for them to think the problem isn't people's consciousness. The problem is in people's orientation to the world. And also, it just is a lot easier to get along as an academic if you're saying that the world out there is all a matter of perception. It's all a matter of how you see it, rather than a fight between contending interests and contending forces, which is the way the left thought of it. So on the one hand, you get a labor movement and a socialist movement that's being defeated and driven back. And so strategic thinking is declining on the left. And within the intelligentsia, you get this embrace of a very idealistic, moralized, cultural way of looking at the world because it's the way they see the world. And it does have fewer professional costs. And so that's why by the 80s, this becomes the dominant trend. And it's no surprise that now, today, for the first time in 40, 45 years, in my opinion, you're seeing strategic thinking reemerge on the left. Why? It's because there is actual organizing going on. There's actual fights around policy issues that for the first time is around real issues and not just culture wars that the media promotes. It came from outside the academy. It didn't come from inside. It came from outside universities. Otherwise, you would have seen this stuff going on forever and ever.
I mean, and I think to some extent, I mean, it feels to me that some of it was there was also sort of like elements of the academy, if you will, that were sort of like shoved to like into some sort of like third place between workers and what the academy had enjoyed, you know, over the past 40, 50 years, right? Like, you had a lot of, like, I mean, I'm thinking about the strikes that started in Wisconsin were started by, you know, TAs and, you know, people who were being exploited in the academy in a way that maybe there wasn't that type of exploitation before. And there were sympathies that were sort of developed, I guess, or people perceived.
Yeah, that has given more of a base for more kind of materialist thinking about politics now. It's limited. You know, the teacher strikes and all that, school teachers, secondary school teachers, elementary school teachers, they face very different conditions than university people, even TAs and RAs. And, you know, the more of a turn to the left came out of the school teacher strikes than from the TAs and what's happening in universities.
Okay. I mean, fair enough. I mean, if I remember correctly, the stuff that was happening in Wisconsin in 2011 in response to Walker was a function of that. And it was because they were, I think it was like, it was over, largely over healthcare, I think too, but, regardless. So once that turn is made, it sort of, obscures this notion of resignation as a response as to why workers are not organizing. And that resignation is just like, I'm damned if I do, I'm damned if I don't type of situation. And so I might as well just go with the path of least resistance.
Yeah. So if you were in a university in 1990 or 1995, what you would be told is that the way capitalism works is it's a system in which there's a lot of domination, a lot of people are being bossed around, but dominant classes, elites have hegemony, cultural hegemony. That's the buzzword that was used. And cultural hegemony basically means that because of their ideological indoctrination, because of their socialization, workers give a consent. They agree to their subordinate position in capitalism. Just the way inside the church, the laity agrees to give power to the priesthood, right? They do it because they're socialized into it. So the idea was capitalism runs on consent. And the consent comes from all this ideological stuff that they're told. And because the dominant class controls media, they control all the political institutions, the universities, all that stuff. Now, this is what I'm challenging in my book, saying that the people aren't fools, they're not idiots. The reason they agreed to stay where they are is because of the stuff that I just brought up earlier about the dilemmas about coming together. So what they do is they don't consent to the system. They resign themselves to it. They kind of shrug and go, well, there's nothing I can do. As you said, there's nothing I can do. If I try to organize, I'll be fired. If I bring people together, we'll probably lose. And if we lose, we're fired again. So until and unless I think there's a real chance of winning, I'm just going to keep my head down. I'm going to try to make the best of this situation. And I'm going to just prioritize keeping my job. I'll do what I can. I might show up to work late. I might try to take more leave than I'm allowed to do. I might even sabotage the work process or, you know, do something to throw, as they say, a wrench in the works while I'm at work. But taking the next step to organizing, that's too much. That means I resign myself.
Does artificially creating, I mean, or you could say manufacturing that consent, right? Like, does that... Is that really a way to kind of ascribe a morality to a system artificially does not exist? It gives it a sense of like, oh, you know, that everybody here is playing by the rules and this is just how the chips fall. Is that how you'd maybe characterize it?
Well, that actually is more of a sense of resignation, which is that, look, this is the way the world is and there's nothing much we can do about it. And people do believe that. That's a sign that they don't think they can change anything. And if you poll American workers over the past 40 years, a lot of them would say that. Would just say, if you ask them, hey, do you like your job? They'd say no. You say, well, why don't you do something about it? Well, that's just the way the world is. That's the response you get. What the ideology tries to do is something more than that, which is not just to say, look, this is just the way the world is. It's you're told this is actually the best of all possible worlds. And if you want to see an ideology that does that, that's what libertarianism is. what libertarianism tells people is, look, you're free. You can get whatever job you want. You don't like a job, quit. You don't like your boss, get another one. You don't like being a worker, become a capitalist. That's the kind of legitimizing ideology that capitalists try to sell. And that's the image of consent. But the truth is, most people on the bottom don't buy that. The people who buy that actually is the winners, is the people on top, is the professional classes, the employers. So the moralistic, legitimizing kind of way of looking at capitalism, saying this is actually a good system, that's the image that the intelligentsia had of what worked believe in the 80s and 90s. And obviously it's false. That, I mean, the intelligentsia's understanding of what workers believe is wrong.
I want to ask if there is a third answer to this. And then maybe this third answer is not actually a third answer, and it is, you know, part of that sort of cultural turn. But if on one hand, the explanation is a certain false consciousness that they've been that workers have been ideologically indoctrinated to not see their own exploitation in this system, and then all the morality that's built around it and this and that. And your argument is that there is a resignation that is a function of the sort of material circumstances that have created, which to me reminds me of black voters not supporting Barack Obama until he wins Iowa, because there was some sense of like, we're never going to get a black president. And so I'm not even going to invest in the idea that we could have a black president because I know that we can't. So I'm not even going to imagine that.
Yeah, it's what happens. Go ahead.
But is it possible that there's also a third answer, which is that maybe this is actually a category error and it's actually part of that first category. But is it possible that there's a third answer insofar as, I know the argument that your argument is that what's the matter with Kansas is wrong because it takes this cultural turn. But what if there is not that this cultural ideology or identification is a distraction, but what if it is within humans? Maybe we're not all, the same, that like once I get my 3 squared and my house over my head, and I'm not too concerned about how much of it is. And, I'm resigned to the idea that it's going to be somewhat stressful. But after that, the things that are important to me are actually not material. Like once I have a basic material floor, then I just move on to other things. And it's not a distraction. It's real. It's my real interest. And what is that? Where does that fall in those categories?
Yeah, I think that's actually pretty accurate. I think that is how people think. But the question is, after the 1950s and such, is that the reason that you see labor movements become kind of meek and mild and started losing members, and you see the labor movement turning away from its kind of radicalism that you found in the 20s and 30s? And for a long time, people thought, yes. See, one reason. So what you're describing, Sam, there was a philosopher in the 60s. He was big among the New Left. His name was Herbert Marcuse. And the New Left thought of him as their philosopher in the 60s. SDS was all reading Marcuse and One Dimensional Man. Marcuse said this. Look, what's happened is unions, and maybe this is what Emma meant earlier when she talked about are unions or is labor part of the legitimizing force? Unions won a lot of great contracts for their members. Wages went up. Working days were limited. They were able to have, the 1.5 cars and the 2.2 kids and whatever. And the idea was, okay, they've become satisfied. They're complacent. And that's why things have now settled down as much as they have in, say, 1958 and 1964. Now, if all that capitalism, if the only way it harmed employees was by suppressing their wages, then having higher wages, like you're saying, would solve a lot of problems for capitalists and for capitalism. But the employment relation, having a job, harms a worker in many other ways than just suppressing their wages. And this came, people realized this in around 1967, 68, 69, when in the midst of having the highest wages they'd had in the 20th century, workers all over Western Europe and in the United States went on a strike wave like they'd never seen since the 30s. The question is, why did that happen? Their wages were really high. They had the cars, they had the houses. It was because there's another side of the job, which is how fast are you having to work? What are the safety conditions? How much recourse do you have to have your boss listen to you if you say there's something dangerous going on? What they found was that in the 60s, 50s, and 60s, wages went up, but there was a huge speed up at work. Injuries were going up, and the unions weren't paying attention to the grievances. Work days were getting longer. The unions weren't doing anything about it. So even while you're getting the car and the house, you can be harmed in 100 other ways at the job, because what the bosses try to do is not only to suppress your wages, but to get the most work out of you, the most labor out of you, to have the most flexible schedule for them, which means an inflexible schedule for you. All of these things come together in the employment contract. And the secret to capitalism is you've never been able to solve all of them together. You can push on in one direction, you can solve some of them, but what employers do is get back through a different channel what they give up through one channel. If the workday is shortened, they increase the pace of work. If the wages go up, they increase the intensity of work. So there's never a time when workers actually experience this image of a settled life, of a decent life, the way that's sold to them. And that's why there's no time when the actual antagonism between employer and employee ever comes to an end.
Did the increase in pay, does that and then the increase in pay and the subsequent contemporaneous sort of diminishing sort of work standards, I guess. Yeah. Does that play into your idea of how you deal with resignation? Will you talk about that, about how, some sense of security that may come with more cash, puts you in a position to feel more empowered, in terms of demanding more?
Yeah. So look, if it's the case, simple question. If today we're all part of an effort to try to revitalize the left and revitalize the labor movement. The question is, how do you go about doing it? You need a diagnosis for why strikes and strike activity is flatlined for 30 years in this country. Okay, if your explanation is, well, it's because of culture and ideology, you ask the question, well, why are they duped so easily? And you figure out, you wag your finger at them and you tell them, don't you see what we see? Don't you see that things are bad for you, et cetera, et cetera? Now, if you believe that that's not the reason, and the reason is that it's the crushing weight of the costs of organizing, then you do what you just said, Sam, which is you try to reduce all the risks and all the costs that they have to take. So two models of organizing. One is you go into a workplace and you moralize the people versus you go into the workplace and you pour resources into it as a kind of a risk reduction scheme for them. You tell them, hey, if we go out on strike, there's going to be a strike fund. You tell them, look, if the employer fires you for organizing, we've got a whole team of lawyers that's going to come in and make sure that you're protected, et cetera, et cetera. It's increasing the security of the job action, and so decreasing the risk. And then finally, you've got to show that whatever goals you have, whatever you're fighting for in this fight, is achievable. And it's not just a pipe dream that somebody from a union office has come up with. We can actually win this. And you show them that you've got an effective strategy for winning it. This is all treating people like rational thinking people rather than as being dupes. And that's the strategy that the left employed for 100 and some years until all of this thinking about organizing and capitalism, et cetera, was taken over by people who are not actually in those movements and in those struggles, which is people like me.
If it's the case that you need to go in on a case by case, shop by shop level and make the argument of, we got your back covered here. This is an attainable goal. That it is a rational decision to make. There's risk involved, but it's not an irrational risk. And is that also an argument from a legislative perspective, let's say, from a more like a 20,000 foot view, for some measure of incrementalism, right? Because if I get the PRO Act passed, let's say, right, or card check, I do sort of non-revolutionary but minor strengthening of the ability of people on the ground to organize, or, you know, that at one point theoretically, or you tell me if you agree with this premise, that at one point theoretically, the straw is going to be the one straw that ends up being pushing over and creating like a critical mass, if you will, in terms of my perception that this is actually not a bad risk to take.
Absolutely. That is the only way to go. What is the PRO Act going to do? What does legislation do? It changes, you might say, the facts on the ground. It changes the power balance, because now, if, for example, card check legislation is passed, now I don't have to stick my neck out as much as I did previously to try to organize, which means my employer's got less power over me. If I have enforceable rights against being fired, which in the U.S. today, they're a joke. You can fire an employee for organizing. It's basically unenforceable that the employer got punished. Say you can enforce it. Now it's changed the risk calculus for me. So absolutely, the legislative process is part of that whole organizing drive that you're doing. And you have to burn that candle on both ends, as it were. You've got to do the organizing and do the legislation. Where we are right now, actually, in the American left is, we're aware of the legislative stuff. Everybody's pushing for that. The problem is there's no real power in the economy. There's no real power that the labor movement traditionally gave to parties so that politicians would feel like they've got to pass something meaningful. And instead, what you get is now like the Biden administration crashing and burning, because it's a big deal that a progressive legislation was even proposed. I mean, something like what we saw in BBB was not even possible 5 or 8 years ago. It's a big deal.
Yep.
Why does it crash and burn? It's not just because of Manchin and Sinema. They just happen to be the front runners on this thing. There's a whole slew of senators, congresspeople behind them, because there's no cost to saying no. There's no cost to trashing this legislation for the politicians, because there's no movement on the ground to help them, to force them to do it. There is a cost to passing it, which is all of their funders are going to get, you know, obviously be very unhappy about that. So the legislative side that you brought up is not controversial right now on the American left. What we need to get more serious about is to try to get some power within workplaces, which traditionally was the real leverage, what gave parties the leverage to pass things like the New Deal.
I mean, there is a sort of like a chicken and egg syndrome here, right? I mean, where we have, Taft Hartley, I think, you know, still resonates and makes it that much harder to develop that type of movement on the ground. I mean, look, we saw the biggest protests that we've seen in decades, probably, over the course of 2020. And there was no... there's certainly from a federal standpoint, there was no legislation passed. And even, you know, in sort of localized things, it wasn't there. And those theoretically came with even less potential risk than you might have if you do that in your workplace. Insofar as that, like, there was not a one-to-one relationship with protesting during 2020 about police reform to your ability to get fired or something like that from your employer. So where is the intervention that is going to, let me put it this way. Is there an intervention that can happen on a grander scale, or is it really just up to, like, you know, you're listening to this program, go into your workplace and organize by addressing, or if you're, you know, working with the union or any type of like a group that's outside of that, go into these workplaces and address all the things that are on the balance of the scale that say like this is a bad idea, right? You know, like start addressing those things. But is there something that sort of can happen more broadly? Do we not have the power, or is it just sort of like tinier pieces of legislation, or is it like bank shots?
Right.
Like, you know, if we had a better system of healthcare, if we had a single payer healthcare system, I'm at work, and if I lose my job, at least I'm going to still have healthcare.
Right. Well, let me start by making a basic distinction here that is relevant to your first question about the massive protests and like Black Lives Matter and all that. There's a big difference between protest and disruption. Protests, it's pretty easy to ignore them if you're in the elites, because what's a protest is a symbolic act. People come out on the streets, they very loudly announce that they're unhappy about something, and they might even rattle some drums and things like that, but then they go home. Nothing has changed. What it's basically like delivering a letter, but it's a lot of people delivering a letter. That's different from labor organizing. Labor organizing wasn't ever a protest. Labor organizing, what mattered, because it has the potential of disrupting the everyday flow of events in a way that neither protest nor other disruption can. And the reason is, what labor disrupts is the flow of profits. And everything in capitalist society runs on revenues coming out of profits, either in taxes or corporate revenues coming out of it, government revenues. Everything comes out of that what is happening in productive establishments. So what labor organizing does is it brings people together. And if they're together in a large labor movement, they are holding a gun to the head of the system day in and day out in a way that no protest can. Because they're saying, not only are they saying we could come out on the streets in large numbers at any moment. That's great if you can do it, but that's not the key. It's that we can shut down the economy at any moment. That's what gets the attention of politicians. That's what gets the government to listen. Now, that is still in its infancy right now. There's lots of protests going on, but there's not much organizing going on. The second part of your question was, okay, how then do you organize? There's no science to this. Yeah, it's going to come through some combination of legislative activity, what you said about the minor, small organizing efforts in workplaces, and then if it's going to work, it has to come together through some process that we don't understand, we've never been able to understand, or we could do it, we would just do it, right? Some process where these things come together into something big, where there is not just a strike here and there, but a wave of strikes. Not just organizing this or that Starbucks and this or that Amazon, but across the board. And that's what we saw in the 30s. Forget the revolutions. Just in the New Deal, we saw that. That's what we saw in the 60s, in the second great expansion of welfare states. That's what we have not seen in 40 years. It's got to go beyond protest. Protest is not what changed. Protest is a part of a cultural shift. Ruling classes can ignore cultural shifts. What they're worried about is, at the end of the day, not getting elected, not making profits, not being able to serve their masters, which is the corporate class. That's what gets their attention.
It's basically the withholding of labor is going to, it's like draining the car of fuel on some level.
As long as you're in capitalism, it comes down to, as long as we're in capitalism, that's what it's going to come down to.
It's fascinating stuff. Vivek Chibber, professor of sociology at New York University, author of The Class Matrix, Social Theory After the Cultural Turn. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will have all sorts of fun.
We will have fun today. I think there's a lot of funny clips.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. We've got a couple doozies. A couple of really doozies.
Really came through with some finds today.
You know what I got to say, and I'm just going to tease this. I'm not going to tell what it is, but Dave Rubin, we have a clip of. Now, look, I don't think Dave Rubin is as an important of a target. I don't think the targeting of him is as important as it used to be, because I think it's quite clear, yeah. You know where he is on the spectrum. He was pretending to be something. I think he was sort of funneling people into a perspective. But what's fascinating about this clip is it includes many of the themes that we talked about today with Vivek Chibber. It is cultural in that it is an attempt to provide a comedy.
Yeah.
And it is also a question of withholding labor, because it is one of the laziest things I have ever seen anyone try and do in comedy. And it is both. It's almost as if he was striking against himself.
Yeah, he's being. Yeah,
right. I mean,
sort of an internal protest that manifests itself publicly.
yeah. Like if he could both separate himself as both worker and actually boss, he as boss would be very panicked.
It's like
what was going on.
A one man play on a one man capitalist critique play.
Yeah.
We could say that, right?
Yep. I think it's one of the most conceptual things he's ever done.
Right.
But we will get to that.
And its laziness. Yeah. So many contradictions.
So many. We will get to that and more. Folks, it is your support that makes the show possible. When you become a member of the Majority Report, you get the free show, free of commercials. And you get the fun half. And you make this show survive and thrive. So become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, what do you do? Oh, wait, you can't. Yeah. No, it's already sold out. It's been sold out for weeks.
But Boston.
Boston is not sold out. Do not sleep on Boston, folks. Because, it's taken me a while to sort of figure out like what I should be doing at these shows. Like, we don't do many live shows, and it's usually because I just like, it is hard for me to sort of figure out like, how do I distinguish this show from the show that we do every day? You want it to be special. Mm-hmm. I put a little bit too much pressure on myself for these things, I think.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the form that makes it special more than the content.
Yes, but I can't. Like, I spent 15 years of my life doing live shows sketch shows were, it was on a weekly basis, but I would go up and do stand up and this and that. And so like the stakes for me on this are higher than they probably should be, but I sort of feel like I have a sense now of what it is. And there's going to be like two types of shows, I think, for the live shows, assuming we do more of these. And they're going to have elements of both, but, deal with the locality that you're at,
mm-hmm.
or get someone, as a guest who is like so universal that it makes it special that they're there. And I feel like Brooklyn is going to be sort of more local. Of course, Neil, we're going to have the whole crew here too. So it's like in our backyard.
Yeah.
Boston. We got a special guest that is like it's a good guest. It's a big guest. Feels like a blimp. Like, you don't see a blimp that often. It's a big deal, right? You go out, you see a blimp, it's like, oh my god, look at the
blimp.
Can't
remember the last time I've seen a blimp.
I'm a grown man, but when I see a blimp, I'm like, whoa, hey, look at the blimp.
Right
I don't know what to tell
you. Would this guest appreciate being compared to a blimp?
Probably not.
Like being compared to a toad or something. No one wants that.
No, toads are more banal.
Okay.
I don't know. I've been excited about toads before, but
I like toads, but I just mean like if you're compared to one, a blimp is big. Toads considered ugly.
I'm talking the symbolism.
Yeah,
of
I get
of a blimp.
Right, but I just have to undercut you in some way. It's more fun.
I don't know what's going on. Folks, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Matt, speaking of blimps, what's on in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, I'm going to be without David Griscom tonight on Left Reckoning.
Just like a blimp.
Yeah.
Solo.
You never see blimps
floating
in tandem.
The air.
Just like a solo blimp. It won't be like the Hindenburg though.
See, the blimp thing really works.
Yeah,
it super works when the Hindenburg is the most readily apparent one. Anyway,
I think Goodyear blimp is also pretty popular.
Okay. Sure. Carl Baer, we've been talking about ideology and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We're talking about do-somethingism. We're also talking about tankies and all sorts of things in between. Also, in the postgame, Gene Bajelan will join me to get a little bit of international relations. I might ask him some industrial questions as well, so we'll see what happens. Patreon.com/leftrecking. And I'm also going to do a little bit of a history lesson on A.C. Townley, the organizer who started the Nonpartisan League, which realized that both third parties are screwed in America, so you need to organize on ballots that you can get on. But the parties themselves aren't to be trusted, so you need to start your own independent power base. And they passed the state bank and the state grain elevator, so I'll be going through that history tonight at 8 Eastern, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
And we'll also, in the fun half, going to be getting into this whole daylight savings thing. A lot of controversy.
This evolution thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, jeez.
Why are we... hate daylight savings? I'm tired. Yeah, it's because of daylight savings. Yeah, exactly.
I know. It's sort of screwed as everybody.
This is my coffee, and I'm like not really even halfway through it yet, so that's the issue.
See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow. What? What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone? Nomi Keen.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that
one. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. 1/2. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes, it's satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.